Good morning. It's my great pleasure to be with you today. As students of engineering, architecture, design, and urban planning, you represent our future. I wish I knew, standing here today, what you will all go on and achieve. However, even though I don't yet know that, I'm sure you're going to change our world for the better. I would like to start by thanking your Chancellor, Professor Guido Saccaro, for inviting me to speak today and to share some of my story with you. I had a very unconventional upbringing, but it was one that taught me the power of innovation and how it can be used to change the world. When I was 7 years old, my father announced that he was taking me with my brother and my mother sailing around the world. He said that he wanted to recreate Captain James Cook's third voyage around the world on the 200th anniversary of his voyage. What I didn't know when we set sail later that year from England was that rather than being away for 3 years, which was what he originally planned, I would be away for 10. During that time at sea, I had very little access to many of the things that we all take for granted, including going to a conventional school. However, the voyage did teach me the power of innovation and technology. One of the critical technologies that we had on our boat was a sextant. This is a seemingly simple piece of equipment covered in mirrors that you can use to find your position on the ocean using nothing more than the sun or the moon or the stars and a very accurate clock. We had other technologies as well. Of course, we had a compass. And later on in our voyage, we had a depth sounder, which enables you to measure the depth between the bottom of the hull and the seabed, but only when you're close to land. And that's very useful, as you can imagine, to stop a boat from running aground. And later on again, we also had some very early satellite navigation equipment. This technology was critical to my life at sea, particularly the sextant and the compass. In fact, it saved my life more than once. Less than a year after we left England, we set sail from South Africa across the Southern Ocean to Australia. This is one of the most dangerous oceans of the world, the Southern Indian Ocean. And unfortunately, we almost immediately encountered a very, very bad storm that became worse day after day. As we kept sailing through the Indian Ocean, the waves around us grew larger and larger. And eventually, several waves combined together, and they surged up behind our boat and smashed down into the deck. They curled over the back of the boat, smashed down through the deck, putting a huge hole in the middle of the deck of the boat and a big hole in the side of the hull as well. It was very clear to my father almost immediately that the boat would not stay afloat long enough for us to get to Australia because we were only about halfway across the Indian Ocean at that point. So we only had one chance of survival, and that was to find a tiny little island called Alamsterdam, which is located in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Most people have never heard of it because it's so tiny. You have to look very closely on Google Maps. To find Alamsterdam, of course, we were hugely dependent on our compass, but also on a lot of luck, because unfortunately, we couldn't use our sextant. You can't use a sextant in the middle of a storm because you have to be able to see the sun or the moon or the stars in order to navigate your position. And we were able to find it through a lot of luck and some very good judgment by my father, who had to decide which direction to try and orient the boat. So we found that island, and it saved our lives. I ended up having multiple operations on that island for a fractured skull. And so I can honestly say that technology has saved my life. Many years later, after I'd left the boat and I'd been to university where I studied science, I went back and I found that compass, the compass that saved our life. In Fiji. It had been taken off the boat and it was then owned by somebody in Fiji. And I still have it today, back in my house in England. In some ways, as I reflect on it, my childhood was very similar to what many people experienced in some ways through the pandemic. You know, like my experience of being a child, many people through the pandemic were confined in quite a small space with limited access to other people. And they were, with their immediate families, unable to go to conventional schooling. However, once again, technology acted as a survival tool. And I think for many children, through using technology and being able to use the internet and computers, they were able to continue some form of schooling and some form of social interaction, even during the most extreme lockdowns. My experience of growing up on a boat gave me a lifelong curiosity for science and technology, which is why I'm so honored to be here today, which is such a hub for that. After teaching myself by correspondence on the boat, so effectively teaching myself by reading books and sending off lessons in the post, I was lucky enough to go to Oxford University to do a science undergraduate degree, and then I went on to Cambridge to do a PhD, also in science. What I learned in university, and which I've continued to appreciate ever since, is that if we use it wisely, technology has the ability to change our lives in very positive ways. I saw this when I later went on to work in the UK government, and during my time when I worked for a management consultancy, McKinsey. In all of those circumstances, I've seen technology, when used well, can be hugely beneficial for society. I now keep on witnessing the power of technology in the companies that I work with today in my role at Exor. These include a sports company, a shoe company, a newspaper company, a truck, bus, and powertrain company, and of course, which is the one that we're talking about today, CNH Industrial. At CNH Industrial, we're really clear that technology can help both farmers and builders to go beyond what they thought it was possible to achieve. One example of this is connectivity. It's now possible, for example, for a farmer sitting on a tractor to get data about the weather, data about the soil, and data about the performance of their machine, all while sitting in their tractor. It's a long way from the sort of tractor that my grandfather had living in the UK as an arable farmer many, many years ago, where he just had a very basic and rather rusty tractor. Now, sitting in a tractor, you have access to a huge amount of information and data. Today's farmer, in fact, doesn't even need to be inside the tractor to access that data, and increasingly doesn't need to be inside the tractor even to operate the tractor. We're now able to connect two machines together, so the farmer is only in one machine, and the other machine connects automatically with it and runs alongside it, so it moves in sync with it. And as we advance our work on autonomy, we can see a day when farmers will not need to go inside the tractors at all, but will be able to control them completely remotely with access to all of the data which I was describing before. All of these advances in technology are making farming and building smarter, more efficient, and more profitable for farmers. One example of this is Case IH. Case IH is one of our global agriculture brands, and they did something really remarkable with connectivity quite recently in Brazil. First of all, we donated 4G infrastructure to a rural area that produces very large amounts of soybean, corn, and cotton, but it was an area that didn't have widespread internet coverage. Then we set up a state-of-the-art connected farm facility in the heart of this region. What this project does is it uses connected tractors and combine harvesters that run Case IH's latest technology and software. This technology, which is sitting integrated into these machines, produces productivity and performance data in real time, which farmers can then use to make their work even more efficient. And this shows the advantages that really advanced connectivity can have and the improvements that it can bring to farm operations and to the community. In the area where we've implemented this project, we're now already seeing big increases in yields, but what we can also see is how it's going to be able to do even better over time, producing more food and saving farmers even more time. So this is yet another example of how technology, when implemented well, can help humanity on many different levels. We've also seen, unfortunately, that when technology is not used well, it can be hugely damaging. Technology can be a source of pollution, a source of destruction, and it can also be a source of distraction, as I'm sure we've all experienced. But part of my job as chair of CNH Industrial, working alongside my colleagues, is to make sure that the technology that we use and promote is technology which is going to serve the humans that will use it, and more broadly, contributes to making a better world by helping farmers and builders to do their jobs better. In my tenure at CNH Industrial, I've been delighted to watch this business develop. And in particular, I'm very excited about our first natural gas tractor for agriculture, which we've recently launched with our New Holland brand. This natural gas tractor, alongside other alternative power technologies, is enabling us to lower emissions from our tractors and other agricultural machinery and construction machinery, and address what we all know is an evolving energy crisis. As we try to accelerate the availability of our alternative power technologies, we're partnering with all sorts of promising newcomers that are disrupting the industry with their innovations. One example of this is the work that we're doing with a company called Monarch Tractors. Monarch Tractors is an American startup, and they're developing the first ever autonomous electrical vehicles for agriculture. So these are effectively electric tractors, and they're electric tractors that can be controlled remotely. We're also working with a British company called Bennamon, whose technology uses methane that you capture on farms to power their tractors. And I was lucky enough to visit some of the farms where those tractors are being used just a couple of weeks ago, and to see how the methane is being captured on the farm and then turned into power for the tractors. So with these sorts of capabilities, we're able to allow farms to achieve full energy independence. Indeed, if you think about methane, which is captured on the farm, you end up with an entirely circular economy. So you capture the methane on the farm, you use it for your tractor, use it for your electricity, it's entirely circular, which is what we're all looking for. The people at CNHI who make this all happen have a huge amount of common with all of you who are sitting here in this room today. It is here, in places like the Turin Polytechnic University, where these sorts of ideas begin. You're learning the foundations that will lead to the invention of the next breakthrough technology or industry transformation. This institution, its professors and students, are valuable partners for CNH Industrial. As you know, we have very deep roots here, and we will continue to foster them. John Elkann, the chairman of Exor, where I serve as chief operating officer, received his degree in engineering here. Exor, as you may know, is CNH Industrial's largest shareholder. And in Italy, 30% of CNH Industrial's engineers are Politecnico alumni. They work in agriculture, construction, IT, precision technology, supply chain, technology, and quality. They're based at our various sites, here in Turin, San Mauro, Torinese, Jesi, Moderna, and Serbo. And the contributions they make every day to advancing agriculture and construction are countless. We're also proud to sponsor the Electrification Masters Program at the Politecnico with our Case Construction brand. Electrification is fundamental to the global energy transition, and we're investing to find the best solutions to get us to that new energy future. So as you can see, we've already learned so much from each other, and there's so much more that we can, and that I'm sure we will, do together. Thank you.
Amazing story, Lady Haywood. When I think about your country, I'm sorry for my less than perfect English. Your English is perfect, by the way.
Thank you very much.
When I think about your country, I see the country where meritocracy was born, basically. And that was one of the results of the Industrial Revolution, the so-called social lift. So people, according to their merits or capabilities, could take the stairs and get wealthiness, but also more impact in society. And but generally, you know, if you are rich, if you are a man, and if you are well connected, I like very much your comparison about being in a boat isolated with what happened to us during the COVID lockdown periods, where our students were at home, and that was especially on the small ones, giving them a sort of damage in their education. We see it clearly. So, but then the first question I would like to ask you is, you were not coming from a rich family. You're a woman, and you've been isolated during your entire adolescence. How could you make it?
Thank you. Well, hopefully this is working. So I think the most important thing for me, and the thing that enabled me to come from, as you say, not the sort of background that necessarily makes it easy to succeed, because I didn't come from a rich background, in fact, quite the opposite. I was very isolated, and I didn't have access to normal schooling. But the thing that made a real difference was education. It was education that was very hard to achieve because I was teaching myself on a boat. But through education, through learning, I was able to get to a point where I could apply to a university. And then frankly, through a degree of luck, I met somebody when I went for my interviews who was willing to take a risk and give me a place, even though I didn't meet all of the entry qualifications. And maybe we'll come on to this point, which is the importance of institutions sometimes looking beyond rules and taking risks on people, even if they don't tick every box that you would like them to tick. But that changed my life, because once I had joined the university, and then I was on a similar playing field to everybody else, I was able to go and do my PhD. I was able then to continue on with my life and to create the career that I've created today. But when I look back, the two things that made a difference was my determination to get an education at all cost, and then the willingness of my university to let me in, even though I wasn't really properly qualified, and to take a kind of risk on me at that point.
Can you tell these guys what was the key point that let Oxford University say, let's give this lady a chance?
Well, I think, there's two things. So first of all, I decided that the way in which I could stand out when I was applying to university was to do something different to what everybody else was doing. Because if I tried to compete to get in the same way as everybody else, I would lose. Because I was doing six subjects. I was studying through Australia. So I was doing six subjects. I knew children in England were doing three. I was teaching myself. They were going to school. So it was impossible. And Oxford asked me to write two essays. And so I thought, well, if I write the standard essay, I want to study biology, the standard essay would probably be something like the discovery of DNA. I thought, I'll never write as good an essay as somebody sitting in a school, because they can go to a library and they can ask their teacher, it will be impossible. So the two essays that I wrote, one was Studying Science at Sea, which was all about how do you study science when you're living on a boat? So, for example, when I did my A-levels, my senior course, I had to do one dissection. And in order to do that dissection, I had to actually go and catch a frog myself on an island. And then I dissected it on my mother's chopping board. So I described how I managed to study science at sea in very unconventional ways. And then the other essay was also just a very obscure topic. It was about whether or not mankind is a domesticated animal. And I deliberately just picked something very obscure on the basis that it was not comparable. And I think the combination of that and the fact that I'd read very widely, so I read every book that I could get hold of on biology, meant that when I turned up, they decided to give me a chance.
And you were lucky to have a good ear from the Oxford University that was not present in other big universities you inquired. So you remember our poet Virgil that said, Audentes fortuna juvat, so the fortune favors the bold. And so is something that is inspiring also your managerial work, this attitude? No, in spite of any boundary conditions, so always give a talent a try.
I think that's right. And it's very much a principle that we follow in the companies, and I know it's something that we're very, very keen to do in CNH Industrial, is to look for talent in unconventional places, and sometimes talent that looks unconventional. You know, it's very easy to assume that the next great engineer looks like every engineer that we've hired before, but actually, talent comes in unusual places and takes unusual forms, and we need to be very open to finding that talent, and we need to be careful that we don't judge people based on things that really don't matter.
Yeah. Well, last bit of information on your personal life. Did you deal with your children the way your father dealt with you?
No, I didn't. I did not load my children on a boat and take them sailing for a decade. I decided that was that, although there were benefits of that, I did see some very unusual parts of the world. It's not an ideal childhood. Mm. So all of my children, I'm happy to say, have gone to very conventional schools.
Okay, fine. Let's come to the topic of this Biennale Tecnologia, that is the relationship among between technology and humanistic. We have big challenges in front of us for humankind: digitalization, energy, mobility, climate change, health. And for sure, technologies are going to play a role in this. But the technology alone cannot make it. We need the combination of different disciplines, and among those, human and social sciences. By the way, he got a master in science and a PhD in philosophy. So you are sort of, you represent this mixture of disciplines. So interdisciplinary resilience, creativity, vision, is it something that is needed now to face the complexity of the world we are living?
Yes, no, absolutely. One thing I was trying to say in my speech was, you know, technology alone is a very, very powerful tool, but technology really only works when you combine it with something that's much more human. It has to be technology that enables humans to be more effective. Technology doesn't operate on its own. So technology in CNHI only works if it's designed in a way that enables farmers to be more productive or builders to use construction equipment in a more effective way. So you have to bring technology together with what people and society need, rather than something that you develop in isolation.
Exactly. In order to drive a company, you have to be inspiring for people, motivate them, and reward responsibility taken by the different people. And in other words, you have to be a leader. What are the characteristics of a leader of a company nowadays?
Well, I think there are a number of different ways in which different people lead, and I think it's wrong to assume that there's just one mode of being a leader. But I think there are some characteristics that I've seen great leaders share. One is, a great leader needs to listen, because if you forget that the people around you probably often know more about the topic than most topics than you do yourself, and you stop listening and you stop asking others for their opinion and their inputs, then I think over time you become less effective. So I think that's very, very important. But a leader also has to have courage, because often you need to make decisions when you don't have full information. You sometimes need to make bold decisions as things change, but you need to base those decisions on as much information as possible. And coming back to your point about kind of combining technology and humanity, I think it's very important for leaders to be human, because ultimately a leader is only successful if the people around them want to follow that leader. You can't be an effective leader without a bunch of people who are, you know, who you are leading. And I think leaders forget that at their peril. You've got to lead and inspire people in whatever way you do it. And as I say, different people lead in different ways, and I've seen different ways that people can do it, but they're always effective at leading other people. They're always effective listeners. And I've always seen them as people who can be brave when the time comes when difficult decisions need to be made.
Yeah. You know, when I was applying, they would say, to become a rector, it's not applying. Okay, it's applying as a candidate. And then I was also myself trying to understand how would have been my job in trying to motivate people. First of all, I had to study a lot because I have been a sort of researcher always in my discipline, and then I was the head of the department of my discipline. But then when I had to motivate architects as an engineer, it's a different story. But that was the time when I became human, in a way. So I read about economics, sociology, philosophy, and I listened to people and their needs. So I spent a lot of time before drawing a sort of program. But I think that one important thing is to let people in a sort of fluid bureaucracy have some responsibility and solve problems on their own. Is it something that you do in your company? I read about this fluidization of bureaucracy and task distribution. Is it something that happens in your companies?
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, often the most interesting ideas come from unexpected places. And I think if you run a company in a very hierarchical way and you only allow ideas to come from the top, you won't find the best ideas. Sometimes the best ideas will come from a young engineer who's just joined. We have an amazing set of engineers, actually, who have joined us now from Raven Industries. We recently acquired a company called Raven Industries. One of the wonderful things about that is it's brought a new group of talented people into our organization. And you will find that, you know, new ideas will emerge all over the place, and you need to give freedom within the company for that to happen. And then a structure which enables the good ideas to progress and the less good ideas, you know, not to progress. But absolutely, I believe that leaders are often not the source of the best ideas, but they can be the facilitators of the best ideas.
And do errors are errors welcome sometimes? So do you accept some errors from people?
Oh, absolutely. So you can't have innovation without things going wrong, almost by definition. So if you have a company that continues to do day after day what it did before, it will, in one sense, it makes no errors because, you know, what worked yesterday probably works okay today, but eventually it will become out of date. If you allow a company to innovate, some of those innovations won't work. And I think you have to accept within a company that risks will be taken in a careful way, you know, based on data and research and thinking, but risks will be taken, and not everything that is tried will work. You know, within CNH Industrial, we're innovating all the time, new machines, new connectivity, you know, new types of data. Not everything we've tried has worked. But one of the things a company needs to do is to watch the things that are being experimented with, stop the ones that are not working. It's a very important thing to learn to stop doing the things that are not working. Not blame the people who tried something that didn't work. In fact, that's a celebration. Learn what you can learn from that and go and innovate and try something else.
Great. But you are not just a leader. You are a woman. And we have so little amount of women in leadership position as yours. Did you feel the crystal ceiling above you in your career, or how did you break it?
So I definitely think, certainly in my generation, it has been, and particularly in the earlier years of my career, I think it was more difficult to progress as a woman than a lot of my male colleagues found. And that's because a lot of organizations weren't set up to support women as they came through. So for example, it was very unusual when I first had children, it was still very unusual in the organization I was in then for people to work part-time. And they didn't really have the system set up to do that. They didn't have, you know, the evaluation system set up to do it. You know, it was hard to take your computer home because they were used to people only working on the computers in the office. All of these things were difficult. What I found is actually during the course of my career, organizations have transformed incredibly and are now much more welcoming to diverse candidates of all different sorts. I still think we have a long way to go. You look at the numbers, certainly in our companies and in other companies, we're nowhere near as diverse as I would like us to be. And it's a huge push that we're doing. in CNH and elsewhere to get more women, more ethnic minorities, more diverse people of all different sorts to come in. Because we really believe that when you have a range of people with different sorts of mindsets and different backgrounds, you come up with better ideas.
So thank you very much. Any company should first make profit. If we assume that the free market is a rule, I believe in free market for sure. But to catch opportunities in such a changing world, probably the conception of a product to solve a problem is becoming more difficult. Is there a new way of thinking about how to conceive products for nowadays society that you are setting in your companies? So the bridge between the needs of people that are ever changing, the potential of the new technologies, how do you select your products and you make decisions in this direction?
So I think what's interesting, again, if I focus on CNH Industrial and I'll think about the kind of farming world, although it applies as well in construction. For me, the kind of transition has been that we now think about a problem in a much wider way than we used to think about a problem. So it used to be that we would think about a problem and we would think about an even better piece of machinery that would try and solve that problem. Now we have a much wider set of tools that we can use to try and address a problem. So if we take an issue like soil productivity, in the past, we could have produced a better tractor, but now we can give a farmer better data about their seeds, about the soil, about the weather, about the kind of productivity of the tractor. So we have far more levers that we can use, and I think therefore it's much easier for us to be problem focused, to actually sit down, talk to a farmer, work out what the specific problems are that they face, and then bring all sorts of technologies to bear on that. And it's not just about the physical iron, the tractor. Often it's just as much about the data and everything else that we can bring that they can use to fix that problem.
I see. So this concept of open innovation, so having, you made me some time, and I heard about this in your speech before, you buy something from outside, there's little companies that are doing something interesting. This is something that is happening more and more, and it is in line with what you said. So try to solve problems instead of upgrading your main product. This is something that you're also launching? So like open innovation calls who solves this problem and then new people come and try to solve them with a startup or not?
No, we absolutely do that. So I think one of the parts of the CNH culture is quite an open innovation culture. So it's a bit like the diversity point that we were talking about before. The best ideas often come from unusual places, and they don't necessarily come from within the company. I mean, many good ideas do come from within the company, but sometimes the best ideas will come from outside. So we're always on the lookout for entrepreneurs that are starting up new ways of doing things that we can either partner with, invest in their businesses or potentially acquire a business, as we did with kind of Raven, to bring those new technologies in. We also try to design our systems so that they're relatively open, so that as people start to develop, for example, new applications, they can connect those systems with the systems that we have on a tractor so that a farmer can always get access to the kind of latest innovations. And I think that is a really important kind of principle for us, is as far as possible to be open to innovation so that farmers get the best new ideas wherever they come from.
On top of profit, there are two main additional goals that are becoming more and more urgent. One is the climate change issue, and so being positive to the environment with your product and be compatible. And this is not just what you do, but also what your component manufacturing do. So it's a chain, something. And the other is the inclusiveness. So trying to have a positive social impact. Are you taking care of this last part in your when you conceive products and you conceive trajectories for the future of your companies? Social impact.
Social impact. No, absolutely. So, I mean, I think increasingly people are demanding of companies that they have a purpose And the purpose is, the purpose has to be more than just making money. Of course, a company needs to make money because it needs to pay its people and pay its suppliers and to pay its shareholders. But I think a company needs to do more than that. It needs to have a purpose. And people who go and work for our companies need to feel passionate about whatever that purpose is, whatever that social impact is. So when I think about CNH, it is very much about enabling farmers to feed the world in a more effective way, enabling farmers to be more effective, and enabling builders, people who are constructing things, to build things that will make the world a better place. We also do a lot of social projects in addition to that. So we do a lot of work, you know, supporting local healthcare. During the pandemic, we did a lot of work trying to kind of support local healthcare providers and local education projects and so on. And we believe very passionately about those. But the core mission of the company is to help farmers and to help builders create a better world. And that's overarching the requirement to obviously be profitable.
And you mentioned in your speech, and you speculate a little bit more on that, some applications that prevent greenhouse gases. So let's talk about the impact on the climate change of your new developments.
Yeah, so CNH is really passionate, very, very passionate about sustainability and has been for a very long time. It's been leader in its industry in the Dow Jones Index for well over a decade in terms of sustainability. However, it still has a very long way to go. You know, I'm very conscious that, you know, CNH is still a carbon emitter, and the by and large, the tractors that we produce are still carbon emitting, as are our construction vehicles. So we have a long way to go. So we're no way complacent. But I am very excited about some of the new developments. So particularly, I mentioned in my speech, the electric tractors, so the smaller tractors, smaller construction vehicles, I think we will be able to electrify, and we're already electrifying them. I mentioned Monarch tractors. The larger tractors, I think technologies like methane are very exciting. I mean, the idea of converting, taking a slurry pit on a farm where you put all the waste from cattle, covering it over, which stops all the methane gas from escaping, and all the rather unpleasant smells, I'd like to add. And then using that methane to power your tractor is really exciting. I mean, it's both, you know, wonderful for a farmer because they get their power much more economically, but it's also great for the environment. So we're very passionate about finding innovations like those and then making them as widely available as possible.
So let's go back to the management, how to be a manager today. Is there something you do particular to motivate talents and to attract talents in your company? Some so special calls? Or how do you, I mean, there are a lot of students here. What do you ask to your potential new employers, employees, to become a member of CNH?
So we're looking for people, first of all, who are excited about the purpose of the company. And I think it's really important nowadays that when you choose a company to go and work for, it's a company where you really believe in what the purpose is going to be. So you need to be motivated by that. And we're seeing a lot of people who are very excited about helping kind of farmers and builders and seeing that as a really important purpose. And then I would encourage people who are joining a company to speak up, you know, even as I said several times as we've been talking, the best ideas often come from very unusual places. So you may well have only been in the company for a short amount of time. You may see something that somebody else hasn't seen. So speak up, you know, create ideas and form connections. We talked earlier about isolation and how difficult it is when people are isolated, either during COVID or as I found when I was younger. When you join a company, creating connections, meeting people, you'll find that's, first of all, a better way to get ideas out, but you also find more ideas, you know, and people will find ways to help you in the company. So we're looking for creative people who are motivated, keen to make a difference, and who like the purpose of the company.
Yeah. What I can say is that the student themselves look for companies like these and would accept lower wages, but this is not a suggestion. If the company gives this perspective, this positive environmental and social impact, and they feel motivated, and this is something that comes from the bottom, from them. Actually, we are trying to do this in changing the way we are teaching our engineers, not just science and the engineering methods that you imagine, you know, but also social and human sciences, also working in groups of different disciplines in order to provide potential solutions or in the second year of the bachelor to big global challenges, and then in the master degrees on innovation challenges that are coming from industry. So Stellantis Group is doing this. And maybe that also from CNH something happens like this. This is as a twofold effect. For us, we get good problems and we have a mentor from industry that follows the students that learn to work the way industries nowadays ask them to work. And for you, you may get new ideas and startups. We have startups already created before they get graduated. And you meet students and you test them how they work and also point out the most creative. Do you enroll also philosophers?
Well, I think if we look at the background of the people in CNHI, we employ people with all sorts of different backgrounds. You and I were having a kind of conversation yesterday, which I thought was very interesting, about what do you learn when you go to university and to school? Do you learn facts or do you learn a way of thinking, a way of, and I think you have something where you talk about educating students to create their own jobs in the future. And I actually believe that, you know, you take from education both facts, but also you learn how to think and how to be creative, how to answer problems, those sorts of things. Because ultimately, as you go on in your career, the facts become out of date. And what you need to do is you need to, first of all, teach yourself the new facts, but also it's those other skills that become very important. You know, the skill to be able to lead, to work in a team, to take a problem and break it down into its component parts and figure out how to answer it. So those all become very important. But I think the initiative that you mentioned with Stellantis, that's the sort of thing that, you know, CNH, I think, is very interested in doing those sorts of things, working with teams of students, creating ideas, and with a very diverse set of people. I think it's not just scientists and engineers. I mean, I'm a scientist, but not just scientists and engineers. A wide range of backgrounds can contribute to the company.
Great. Actually, yesterday I opened the Biennale Tecnologia by mentioning this. So universities should teach students to create their own job, which I called it Politecnico 5.0. We are now in Politecnico 4.0, where we are keeping the light of creativity on with these challenges, but then the next step for me is what we said. What is the next step for you? What is the company of the future? This is my last question. If you close your eyes and you see what CNH will be in 5 to 10 years, is it going to be different from what is it now or not?
Well, first of all, I'm sure it will be different. I mean, I'll be very disappointed if it's not different because companies have to keep evolving. They have to keep evolving because the world is changing. You know, the demands, the sustainability demands are growing. The demands from farmers are increasing. The opportunities for us to bring in new technologies, you know, they're there all the time. So I am sure CNH will look very different in 5 years to how it looks now. But I think it will still be serving the same purpose. I think it will still be figuring out ways to help farmers and builders. But I suspect it will be doing it in a very different way. I think the one trend that I see continuing is, although the equipment is always going to be at the heart of what we do, the things that we put around the equipment, the connected farm, the data, everything else, that is going to become much more important over time. And the equipment will remain at the heart of it, but it's going to be a much, much broader offer that we can make to kind of farmers and builders to make their lives better.
Okay. So, dear Suzanne, Lady Haywood, it has been really a pleasure to meet you. Your story is fantastic. I think you need someone to write a book on you. You wrote a book on your husband, and that could be inspiring for me as a servant of the public, the state, I would say. But yesterday I talked about your story with Marco Paolini, that was delivering a wonderful theater play yesterday night on technology and humanity. But your story should become a theater play, in my view. And maybe I'm going to get back to you, because we're going to have a meeting on that with Marco Paolini. We are a little early. I would like to change, and maybe someone is wish to ask something to Suzanne. Someone of the students, of course. Please get down and get the okay. If you go up, it's there at the end.
Thank you for your talk. Talking about the characteristics of the leader, you say that one of the things is to inspire people. How we can reach that, to inspire being a leader, to inspire the people?
Well, so I can tell you how I try to do it, but I do think different leaders do it in different ways, so I don't think there's just one recipe for doing it. I think what I try to do is, it's based on my experience of how I felt that I was inspired by leaders as I came up. First of all, I do try to kind of listen and involve people because certainly I found that inspiring when I worked with people who I felt kind of listened and involved me, and I was part of creating ideas. And then I think the other thing that a leader can do is to set out a clear vision, which people can rally around and get excited about. This point about purpose, I think, is very important and is getting increasingly important in this world. And I think there's also something about a leader also being calm and being able to be reflective, because day to day, all sorts of things happen, as we know. And I think it's very important for people to see somebody who can lay out a way forward and be able, you know, not be too kind of rocked by things that happen kind of day to day. But as I say, there are various different ways of leading. Those are some of the characteristics that I think are very important that have inspired me when I've looked at other leaders.
There is a student there wishing to ask something.
I wanted to ask who inspired you, or what keeps you inspired despite adversities?
Inspiring questions. The second.
Who inspires me? Lots of people, really. Let me think. So, you know, I was very, and many people here today will have a kind of similar experience. I was very, very inspired. I had one teacher when I was learning correspondence on this boat, who was my biology teacher. Who I never actually met at the time. I eventually went back a couple of years ago to Australia and met him. But at the time, of course, I never met him in person. I never actually even spoke to him. But he was very inspiring. He wrote me letters to encourage me to keep studying. He sent me books to read. He helped me with those essays that I kind of mentioned before. He was a very inspiring person for me. And I think a lot of people who I talk to who've been successful in their education have had at least one teacher that's inspired them at some point. So that's very important. And then through my career, I've had leaders who have inspired me in various different ways. And they're often people who I was describing before, have that combination of being a good listener, being very human, but being able to set out a clear vision and being calm. And I've worked with some very good leaders actually in my time in government and in McKinsey and in Exor and in the company. So I've been very lucky. I think I've seen many different forms of leadership.
Let's say one last question. Please stand up and ask the question.
As you said, the leader has to be very calm, but how can you handle pressure at your level?
It's a good question. How do you handle? So I think, first of all, one of the things that I've kind of learned over time, and I guess I've seen other people do, is you don't want to kind of jump as soon as something happens. You need to kind of take time to reflect where you can. You do, as I've talked about a few times, you need to listen to others, because sometimes you can find yourself in a bit of a bubble and somebody outside of that bubble will suddenly point out, actually, when you step back from this immediate issue, you can look at it in a very different way. I actually would also encourage people, it's very important to look after yourself as well. So, you know, I do try to exercise, I try to get outside, I try to spend time with my family. I think having a balanced life, even as a leader, is really important, because it does enable you to stay kind of grounded and kind of calm. I think it's very easy to get, there's always more things that you can do every day. There's always more work that can be done, more studying, another lesson that you can read, but you need to create some balance in your life. As various people have reminded me, you know, this is a kind of marathon, not a sprint. You know, I'm sure you're working incredibly hard now. You'll work very hard when you move on from here to, as I mentioned before, kind of very exciting things. But you have to remember that you've got to, you know, it's a marathon. You've got to take care of yourself as you move on as well.
Another question here, please. You can step and then ask.
Okay. Firstly, I want to say thank you to Ms. Haywood and also Professor Salako. Thank you for this great talk. And I'm very inspired by your story, and I feel more energetic, or I can see have more strength about my academic career, but I'm still a little bit confused about my situation now. I'm from a foreign country, and when I first arrived in Italy, I'm not so used to the educational system and the life here, so I spent some extra years as under students in the bachelor degree. And now I'm in the postgraduate school, also in Politecnico. And now I'm thinking about because the age problem, and also about some, I don't know how to say, I'm not in a so prevailing situation, not so good situation compared to other students in the same class or in the same life situation. So I was thinking that, do you think that is it a real problem for when you are not in a good situation, you are not so competitive with other,
colleagues.
Other students.
Yeah, the students, okay.
Yes, this. So that's my question. Thank you.
It looks more like a question to me and to the Italian systems of handling students. I mean, we have to improve to let you feel more at home. And but basically, what she said is that they are giving talent a chance, and if you are creative, and then if they give you a job, you're going to be well off for sure. Anyway, we are trying to, and we have to, take care of you as foreign students coming here, because we have this lowering of the birth rate in Italy that is tremendous. In a few decades, we are going to have serious problems in finding human resources. So one of the most important things that we as a university do with our nearly 20% amount of foreign students enrolled is to bring people and human resources here, train them, and give, with our action on pushing the economy and the in industry, a chance to find a job here. You're more than welcome, and let's talk about your case in private, and I will see what we can do. So, I have a last question. I'm curious about one thing. You did a lot of sport when you were a teenager. Sailing, isn't it? Do you do sport now? Are you training something? Are you playing something?
Well, not so much. So living on a boat, of course, you can do some sports, but not other sports. So when I grew up, I I did do some swimming, although it's hard to swim when you're sailing across an ocean, for obvious reasons. Obviously, I did a lot of sailing. Later on, when we were sailing, we had a windsurfer on board, so I learned how to windsurf, so I can windsurf, slightly bizarrely. A little bit of roller skating. But what I wasn't able to do was very much team sports, because you can imagine, you can't really play football on a boat or tennis or something like that. So nowadays, I love walking. I do try to keep fit. I do love kind of getting outside and kind of doing things, but less kind of organized sport. And I think that is one of the things, you know, that and actually learning a musical instrument and learning languages, I think, are three of the things that I particularly kind of missed in my childhood. But I think however you do it, you know, getting out, as I was saying before, getting out, exercising, keeping fit is really important. And to the last student who spoke, I think everything you said was very wise, but I also want to say it's very easy, particularly early on in your life, to be very conscious of where people are relative to you, a year or two ahead or a year or two behind. And I found that at particular points in my career, because I've been an outsider coming in, so other people have had an advantage over me. They've been able to move more quickly because I've come from a different background. However, having that diversity of background, coming from somewhere else into Italy, is actually also a huge strength. It may mean that you move a little bit more slowly to start with, but you have a set of experience and knowledge that other people won't have. And I've certainly found that at various points in my career that, you know, I felt like I was moving more slowly, but then later on, I've discovered that because I've taken a slightly unusual route, I've got experience and knowledge that other people can't bring.
So let me thank once more you for your being here and your speech and our dialogue that I'm sure it was appreciated by the audience. And I'm looking forward to a stricter cooperation between Politecnico and your companies, I would say. And I'm a Juventus fan, by the way.